Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today for the last time by Bradley Gerrard, news editor. How are you doing, Bradley?
I'm good, thank you, John.
Yeah, looking forward to leaving us, are you?
Well,
dumping us.
I wouldn't say that necessarily, but a different challenge.
Yes, indeed. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
On air, and obviously I'll say that to you again later. Anyway, and Alex Newman, how are you doing, Alex?
I'm okay, thanks. I'm not going anywhere.
Good. I'm glad to hear it, because I've got lots of plans for you.
Okay. Ominous.
Not ominous. All good stuff. So, we've had a busy week this week, particularly on the oil and gas front. Results from the oil majors, Shell and BP. There's some stuff going on at the small end of the market that's quite interesting as well that we're going to talk about.
And at the midpoint of the market as well.
And the midpoint of the market, yeah, my everywhere. Goodness. Across the board. But yes, let's start with what's been happening in the news this week, Bradley.
Yeah, I guess one of the interesting things out of 7 days, obviously we're starting to sort of see a bit of a mixed picture among sort of, you know, retailers. And I guess Aldi, their continued march was particularly interesting this week, because they passed 6.2% market share of the UK grocery market, which doesn't sound like much, but it actually now puts them in the top five and meant they leapfrogged Co-op. And that data came out actually on the same day that Richard Pennycook, who is the Co-op chief executive, suddenly announced he was stepping down. So Aldi, who is making a big play in terms of growth, especially, there's lots of stories about both Aldi and Lidl employing more people, building more stores against the incumbents. And it just, I guess it's interesting from a retail perspective to look at the very divergent fortunes of winners and losers. And so we had Dunelm results yesterday, not a retailer in the same ilk as Aldi, but consumer facing, and they've had a real struggle.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a company specific issue based on an acquisition that they've recently made.
There are specific issues, yes, of course, but it's still nonetheless the trading wasn't strong enough to offset some of those things. So, and even the other retailers, you know, sort of Next is looking a bit patchy the past few months, whereas other companies who do a similar thing, maybe online focused businesses like Boohoo and etc., seem to be still doing quite well. So it is interesting. There's definitely something opening up in the retail about, I guess, as an investor, starting to look at about being picky, really.
Funny if you mentioned Next, because Mr. Bearball this week has looked at Next, and he's actually thinking of buying it now that sentiment is at a low ebb.
That can be a good time to buy a stock.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, yeah, you talk about Aldi, you know, it's taking market share. But you know, some of the bigger supermarkets, Tesco, Morrison, have had a good recovery this year. And Sainsbury's is kind of holding its own.
So. Yeah, and also, obviously, we've seen last week, you know, Tesco's very big deal, potential deal with Booker, which could be, transformational in terms of Tesco's presence in another sub-segment, I suppose, of the retail market. Obviously, Morrison's looking at restarting the Safeway brand as a kind of rival to Booker as well. So those businesses are changing too. And then obviously we've got Sainsbury's making the play with its purchase of Argos. So those businesses are changing too. And how that will impact their sort of share of the grocery market would be quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Richard Pennycook was obviously the chief of the whole Co-op group, which includes the banking operation and a number of other things. Well, he was formerly the FD of Morrison.
Oh, interesting.
He was indeed. His departure from there was seen as a bit of a bad omen, and so it proved, as it happened.
Well, perhaps there's a further bad omens to come for Co-op then.
Well, maybe we'll so. See. But then you would think that, you know, that's the one that people are going after rather than Tesco, rather than Sainsbury, rather than Morrison's.
And, yeah, absolutely. Because those three you just mentioned, their market share is obviously well above the likes of Aldi and Lidl.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and this isn't necessarily a story of the consumer being weak, because we are seeing continued good demand for housing, for example. Now, it's not necessarily a pure consumer story, but it's related.
Yeah, it's related to confidence of consumers, absolutely. And in December, the sort of the credit figures weren't quite so good, and that was partly linked to a reduction in mortgages, but still the absolute number is still pretty decent. And as you say, there's a bit of a wobble from some of the estate agents, but generally I think I would say that the housing market in the UK is still pretty robust. And although there are fears about what Brexit might mean for it, we still have, as we've written a news piece this week, a chronic shortage of housing. And there was a white paper out this week which bids to sort of help solve that problem. But really,
yeah, there was some criticism of this paper for not going far enough.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit soft, really. One of the things that some people want is for the house builders to be forced to build on plots of land that they own more quickly. So what is quite often the case is house builders will buy land, then they'll get planning permission on it, and they might not for years actually build anything on that plot of land. And there is a consultation question in the white paper asking generally whether the government should enforce a 2-year limit. So once you've got planning permission, you have to build something on 2 years. It's about 3 at the moment, apparently. But they haven't pushed that through. They've asked the industry whether that would be a good thing.
Well, the industry is obviously going to say no.
I would presume that would be the case. So the government hasn't been as hard as it could have been, in the eyes of some, of course. Potentially pandered still a bit to the house building industry. And yeah, you have to ask that, yes, while there are some developments in terms of the government's kind of acceptance that maybe we can't build a house for everyone to own, so maybe we need to look at what we're building, whether we can build more rental properties, and better gear the financial clout, I suppose, of the private sector. And that's something we have started to see, people like Legal in general, getting involved in this build-to-rent thing. So that's a potential income stream for big pension funds. And let's face it, the private sector has the cash. The public sector does not really have the cash to reignite property construction from its almost zero base in the public sector.
Yeah, I mean, this is the big hole in house building is the social side of things, the government-led side of things. That's not coming back.
Last year at a wedding, I met a guest who was an architect, and he was doing a housing project for, I think it was Sutton was the constituency. The first time they've ever even thought about building a house in 20 years, that local government agency. So it just shows you that the public sector has really, really not built many properties at all, not just in London and the Embrons, but nationally as well. It's a big hole to fill. And as we've said, the private house builders, it's in their interest to sit on land, because if prices are going to go up, they might as well wait for them to do that and then build some more houses to realise that higher price for them.
Yeah, so I mean, nothing to worry about. I mean, you know, that if you want exposure to the housing market as an equity investor, it's the house builders generally. Nothing in this white paper to suggest that times are going to get any more tough for them.
Not right now, no. The only things that could crop up are, of course, if somehow the government does push builders to construct things more quickly, that could, in a rising market, obviously, then potentially limit the upside in sale prices that such companies could achieve. And there's also talk of support for smaller house builders, but how much that would really seriously dent or eat into the types of and size of business that the larger house builders do, I'm not entirely sure that it's a big threat, albeit it could be a small one.
No, and I mean, this week we've had results to emphasise the point from Redrow, which were decent, more than decent. The share price there has recovered from an intraday low of about £1. After post-Brexit, what is it now? £4.70 a share.
Yeah, it's just remarkable. The house
builders, we kind of suspected that the sell-off on Brexit fears had been overdone on the day of the referendum, but not a bounce of this magnitude.
No, exactly. It's quite remarkable. But as you say, there was just, I guess, unbridled fear and confusion post the referendum. It took, I guess, people in the locations whereby maybe stock trading is more prevalent, like London, by surprise. Perhaps in other areas of the country, it wasn't such a surprise. But it caused a real schism in markets. And Jonas, our property correspondent, rightly said, this is all a storm in a teacup. And let's face it, let's look at the actual fundamentals of the house builders. They're sound. The country needs more housing. They're well-financed businesses. You know, there's nothing really to panic about yet until the economy goes off a cliff and house prices plunge indefinitely.
Indeed, not easy to phase Jonas Crossland.
It's not, no. He's a cool character. Cool character. He won't be flustered.
Indeed. Okay, let's talk about the big oil and gas stories that are in the news section this week. Where should we start, Alex? Should we start with Ithaca?
Let's start with Ithaca. I think that's the biggest story. We knew that BP and Shell results were coming out, but we didn't necessarily know that Ithaca was going to be taken over. So 20% shareholder Delek, which is an Israeli conglomerate, on Monday launched a bid, which was accepted immediately by the board, and they've urged shareholders to accept it. I mean, it's a little bit frugal. It's a little bit frugal. It's 11% premium to the UK shares. But it's worth considering, I mean, a few things. Obviously, we had some readers who are a bit disgruntled, upset with the price because they see the Greater Stellar Area asset, which is just about to start generating cash for Ithaca, as a huge missed opportunity, really, for shareholders to benefit.
And that was the basis, that potential was the basis for the tip that we recently published on Ithaca.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were looking forward to that next chapter as well, because this is a really, really major North Sea development. It's going to be very interesting to see how that might spur additional investment in the North Sea as well, once you've seen how, you know, this really strong management team's ability to get this project over the line, though it has faced some delays over the last couple of years. But that's probably unlikely to be the case. In the end, our advice, or my advice, was that this bid, where, you know, though it could have been a little bit more, is about fair, and Delek, as the shareholder and now the acquirer, have stuck with the company through some pretty tough times in the last couple of years. So they bought in November 2015, at a premium, when the shares were below 50p. They've watched the share price rise about five times in the last year. So it's not like they've been as opportunistic as they possibly could have been. They have waited for some sort of assurance, as the market has done. I think as the market has benefited from that as well. So investors, you know, should have been looking at a gain in the last year, certainly.
Yeah, it's been a good tip then. So, I mean, we tipped that at the end of November. It's up about 50% since, so good work there.
Yeah, I mean, we had tipped it before, you know, and it was prior to the oil price decline. So that, you know, it's worth balancing out the two points at which we decided the Ithaca story was a flyer. But I mean, most recently, I think it's been a stronger call, I think.
Yeah, Delek are involved in another UK listed company, Faro Petroleum, which you mentioned in this piece.
Yeah, so it's interesting on the day to see Faro shares rise quite a lot, just on the news of their peer being taken out. So they, in December, received around about 14% stake from Delek as well. This company's got a lot of cash on its balance sheet. It's clearly seen there's some value opportunities in the North Sea. Faro, along with Ithaca, have been very, very good at reducing operating costs. Obviously, costs have come down across the industry, but they've clearly seen the value opportunity for North Sea producers. And, you know, it wouldn't be surprised if, you know, there may be an additional stake taken there. Obviously, they're getting towards the level whereby they might need to make a formal offer. But we'll be speaking with Fair on a podcast in the next couple of weeks. So hopefully we can get a bit more information from the management when we do that.
All right, good stuff. I mean, you know, obviously it's interesting because the overarching narrative regarding the North Sea is one of decline.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the talk at the moment is about how these projects are getting decommissioned. Shell, whose results were published in the last week as well, they basically pulled out. I mean, there's some motions by the chief executive, Ben Van Beurden, sort of suggesting that, no, they're still committed to the North Sea, but they have just sold a huge chunk of their assets there.
But then someone's bought them. So
someone has bought
someone
them.
Someone else has seen opportunity there.
There is the opportunity. But, you know, to what degree these assets are going to be run for cash? I mean, they're obviously going to require some capital investment as well. Whether they're going to be run for cash or, you know, expanded sort of remains to be seen. So it is a very uncertain time for the North Sea. Obviously, labour has been decimated as well in Aberdeen and the economies which service the region as well, which doesn't make it that easy to, you know, for companies just to pile back in.
No, interesting. I mean, you mentioned Shell. Obviously, they had results this week. BP have had results this week, and this is interesting because these are the two big guns, and it's quite a contrasting story there.
It is, but they are both, if you look at the yield, which in a way is the market's proxy for how they're being valued, and when we'd normally look at companies with a nearly a 7% yield, that would be a bit of a red flag.
Yeah, you'd be a bit cautious, yeah, and circumspect.
But they're both trading roughly at that level at the moment. But I do think, you're right, the sentiment is sort of, I think, split a little bit. And we've lent over the years with Shell. I mean, partly that's due to this continued onerous payments for the Gulf of Mexico spill, which, you know, they're still eating up, you know, billions of dollars a year for BP. But it's where they are in the investment cycle. So Shell last year acquired BG. That was a big capital outlay, big strategic, bold move. Some place serious questions over the gas exposure there, and we, you know, we still have some concerns. But BP is now doing its investing now, and that is placing some quite heavy strains at this point in the cycle on their cash. So the market reaction to BP's results this week was a bit of a sell-off, whereas despite weak earnings at Shell, there was a sort of positive bump on the day. That's since declined, but when they published their results.
And I think you talk about in the piece the difference between, you know, it is related to this investment cycle or the relative points at the investment cycle that Shell and BP are in. Shell, it's now significantly more cash generative, and that supports a dividend, which is what we're all interested in, of course.
Yeah. Absolutely. So it plays to the dividend story, and Shell has based its whole strategy around creating what they call these cash engines, so that they can continually build their sources of cash. They obviously punish the cost base as much as they probably can do. If you're going to be bullish on BP, you'd say, I mean, it costs to invest in the future, and these are the sort of holdings we don't really recommend. Investors, you know, are looking to flip on a month by month basis. These are long, sort of decade long core holdings. So BP, in their defence, would say, "Look, we're building for the future." Fair enough, but it's still, you know, it still could make for a slightly rocky year for their shares, I think.
Okay, interesting. Let's stick with the results section for the time being. Next week's cover feature, which you are also writing for us, Alex, been a busy couple of weeks for you.
Yeah,
is mining. Which has also had a fairly strong recovery from the low points of last year. This week we've had results from Rio Tinto, which looked good, and Randgold Resources, the gold miner, which looked good. Comments.
Randgold was sort of beaten to the punch a week ago. Their peer Centamin, which owns the Sukari mine in Egypt, I think they quintupled their dividend, which putting them on a sort of 7% yield has really sort of locked in, I think, their share valuation, which obviously for gold miners is very, very subject to the, you know, the volatility of the commodity which underpins it. Randgold hasn't decided to match that. They're focused, like BP is, on building projects for the future, which, you know, many of their peers have questions over. You know, their gold mines don't tend to last forever. Randgold's still hiked their dividend to $1 a share. I mean, it doesn't really put them onto a sort of high yielding basis, but they've still got an enormous amount of cash on the balance sheet. And this is an interesting period for gold miners, I think. Do they go out and buy smaller companies? Do they build projects? Do they return cash to shareholders? They're having to make some strategic decisions, but I think these are all decisions which investors can probably look on with a bit of hope, because they should be adding value to the company.
I guess an important aspect of that decision-making process is trying to understand where the price of the underlying commodity is going. Obviously, in this case, gold. It's had a good week.
It has, yeah. So I think I checked this morning, it was up to about $1,240. After Trump's election, as I'm sure we've talked about on this podcast before, the expectations were that gold would sail away with this unpredictable new administration. It collapsed, and that's probably because people piled into equities and other asset classes, which...
And the dollar got stronger.
Yeah, and the dollar got stronger, of course, which offer a yield and return, which obviously gold doesn't. I think some of that sentiment is peeling away now, and that is inevitably going to be good for gold. Gold tends to move in one direction, and it's rarely, really flat. And I think since the beginning of the year, the rally, I would say, probably speaks to political uncertainty. I mean, another strong month for buyers of coins and bars, which suggests there's still, among retail investors, there's quite a lot of hope for the metal in the year ahead, or perhaps little hope for the rest of the world. But
I think my personal view on gold, which I've written about before, is that I think it's just a sensible insurance policy to have a little bit of gold, and preferably through physical methods rather than through ETFs. I mean, that's just my view.
Yeah. I suppose the bonus then, you know, if we're talking about companies, is that gold miners do offer the chance of generating some income and some cash whilst getting exposure on a leveraged basis
to the asset. Plus the gearing, yeah.
Yeah, so But, you know, as ever, it's a volatile space. So it's, you know, we remain cautious, if slightly optimistic this year.
So let's quickly talk about Rio. I mean, is that a commodity price story as well? Or is there something more going on there?
I think the story they wanted it to be about yesterday was that they remain an income stock. A year ago...
Actually, that's a chunky yield.
Yeah,
I don't ever remember seeing... I mean, they've always been a big payer in absolute terms, but not at that level of yield.
I think it has been this yield before. I mean, the issue they've had, obviously, in the last 5 years is the slow decline of the main metals they're exposed to. In the last year, it's been very, very strong for iron ore and coal, and no one really saw that coming. But that was based on some Chinese stimulus in the second half. But they really want to be seen as a dividend stock, so and a shareholder return stock. So a year after canning their progressive dividend, they've returned to the table with a 170 cents a share full year dividend, which is 70% of their underlying earnings, and that's well above their restated policy. So they're clearly looking to get, you know, the traction with investors. Once again on that front, which might potentially point to some uncertainties they have about their end markets, that now they want to be an income stock rather than a value play. But I mean, a large diversified miner, that's what they're really there for. They should be returning some income to shareholders.
All right, interesting. But that would suggest it's no longer a growth story, which in years past, I mean, not too long ago, I mean, mining was not a... They paid dividends, but they weren't an income play. They were a growth play because it was a play on the Chinese supercycle, basically.
Yeah, I mean, and which remains very uncertain. So last week, we saw Chinese central bank raise overnight short-term lending. Immediately, you see a sell-off 3-4% of all the big miners. So there's real concern in the markets and the big investors which hold these stocks that at any moment now China is going to start this transition to consumer economy, which
we've been talking about for a long time.
Yeah. But you know, and that probably speaks to as well the huge gains in the share prices in the last year, that there might be, you know, now might be the time that some people are looking to take profit. So. I think, as we said in the FTSE 350 outlook for the year, it's all about the metal weighting this year. And iron ore, I think, which the big miners are heavily exposed to, looks a little bit uncertain for me.
Okay, interesting. And you've written something else. I think we will we'll leave readers to have a look at this one in the magazine. This new company on AIM, Diversified Gas and Oil, which is a very interesting new model.
Yeah, it's a boring name, but...
Sounds really boring.
But, you know, we like boring, I think, generally.
Okay.
It is diversified in the sense that most junior oil and gas companies which come to the market promise an asset somewhere in the ground that is going to, you know, that is going to reap huge rewards for shareholders, you know. Several times out of 10, that's not going to be the case. And they're often exposed to one asset, which leaves them very, very vulnerable to share price collapses when they're not able to get future financing or they don't hit the pay dirt they're expecting. This company, Diversified Gas and Oil, already has producing assets. It has thousands and thousands of very small wells. These are probably wells which are sitting on a farm somewhere in the US, in the Appalachian region, which might be producing a few barrels a day. But their model is that these are very, very low-cost assets. They're buying them up on the cheap because the US conventional oil companies are looking to pour back into the shale industry. That means they can hoover them up at a big discount, and they're looking to sort of effectively become a cash-generating income stock. They're still very small, but it's a really interesting alternative. It's almost like an asset management style of running a natural resources company. But I thought it's worth flagging because they are... You know, they're pretty different to almost every other oil and gas company I can see in the market.
All right, one to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
Bradley, let's talk about a couple of pieces you've written. Reckitt Benckiser, which is making this acquisition, which nobody seems particularly convinced about.
Yeah, well, I mean, kind of like Alex said about Shell and their deal with BG, this is kind of a big play for Reckitt. The size of the potential deal, they're looking at buying a company called Mead Johnson, which is a US-based company and is... pretty much entirely based around its products like infant formula and powdered baby milk, that sort of thing.
Massive demand for that. Talking to China again. I mean, China, they're, you know, I've seen countless articles talking about the exploding demand for infant formula.
Globally, yes, you're absolutely right. And even a UK company that you wouldn't think was exposed to it, Dairy Crest, they've recently started producing the enzyme, I guess it is, a key one that goes into infant formula, and they're working with a big New Zealand company that's huge in the infant formula market. So yeah, people are kind of seeing it as an interesting thing to get into, but with this potential Reckitt deal, it's just so big. So the size of the deal, if you include Mead Johnson's debt, is going to verge on about $18 billion. And that basically is going to be more than five times the size of the SSL deal that Reckitt did a few years ago.
Which was very successful.
It was successful. But it's going to be twice as big as all the deals they've ever done, Reckitt, since 1999. So it's a big, big play. It's a big, bold move. It doesn't mean that Reckitt hasn't got the management experience to potentially deliver this. And they've obviously got experience of, you know, integrating acquisitions previously. But RBC, a broker, is particularly bearish about the deal, and they actually downgraded the stock to underperform. Their view actually is that Rakesh Kapoor, who's the chief executive of Reckitt, outlined these three sort of hurdles that any potential acquisition had to be able to jump. Those being that it was strategically compelling, it would be worth more to Reckitt Benckiser than its existing owner, and it would create value and not just increase EPS. Now, RBC doesn't think that this deal does any of those things. They're actually very sceptical about it because Reckitt doesn't have experience in infant milk formula. So it's a completely new category. It's a very big purchase. Sales at Mead Johnson have been going downhill. So 2015, I think it was down 3%, last year down 2%, expected to be down 3% this year. That's percent. So it's going to be, if it comes off, it's going to be a fantastic deal. And everyone who is a bit more bullish on it will say, yeah, told you so, that the experienced management team of Reckitt could deliver it. We always thought they could. But it's a big, big business to take on. I mean, Reckitt's global, but Mead is also global as well. And so there's going to be a lot to manage. And it doesn't really seem like a quick cost-cutting job to boost the value. It seems like there's going to have to be a real sales rejuvenation, which could be quite, you know, capital intensive potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I look at Reckitt and I don't immediately think food. And, you know, infant formula, I mean, it's a different type of food, but it's still food.
Yeah.
You know, I look at Reckitt and I think, you know, consumables, cleaning products, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I can see how people would think it goes outside of its comfort zone. But yeah, hey.
That's part of the concern. But as I said, there are people that are bullish, but there are, even among those, there are certain things that they pick up. They're like, yeah, this is a thing to just be aware of, kind of thing. So Reckitt actually has results on Monday, which I'll be here to cover.
You're going
to
cover them?
My last day.
Yay. Yeah.
So it'll be very interesting to see what they say and what they get asked about the deal and their response to any scepticism about it.
I suspect it will rather be like a Theresa May PMQs.
Yeah, it'll be like, the Mead Johnson acquisition means the Mead Johnson acquisition, and that's probably all they'll say.
I will add, Reckitt Benckiser, when I used to cover, you know, consumer products, I always got it wrong. I could never see the value in it, and yet it's been a brilliant performer.
Why were you always bearish, John?
I kind of thought it was always overvalued. I always thought the shares were too expensive. I thought the change of management was going to be a kind of point for stumbling. And I kind of looked at some of the products and thought that they could easily be replaced by some of the non-branded products that people like McBride would be selling, or producing at least. And I looked at this kind of albatross it had around its neck in the form of the pharmaceutical business, which it's now spun off, you know, which was always a drag. But they've spun it off. They've done very well to spin that off, and that in itself is doing all right.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I think this is a group that defies expectations.
It is, and some of the analysts actually say in their notes, like, if you ask them for remarkable growth in a certain metric, they deliver it and more. So they have got great history of doing this, but I think just the size and scale of this is an issue. And also an interesting thing that just popped into my head, Mr. Kapoor was obviously a very sort of big target, I suppose, for the those against high CEO pay.
Mm, indeed.
Last year, you know, there was a lot of sort of ill will against the size of his salary. If this deal does go ahead and he doesn't really deliver very well on it, that will be very interesting.
Yeah. So, but he's taking a risk here.
Of course he is.
You know,
you've got to say,
you know, he's earning a big pay packet, but in taking on a deal like this, he's trying to earn his salt at least.
Yes. And that's the key to it, really, I guess, is this acquisition truly strategically sensible, which Mr. Kapoor said was one of his sort of hurdles for an acquisition, or is it, we need this because our own organic growth is slowing and it's going to be too difficult to ignite on our own? Yeah. That'll be the big question.
You could argue that sort of remuneration strategy is a tautology in a way. So you're saying you pay me a lot, so I will therefore take big risks. But, you know, big risks in and of themselves aren't necessarily good.
That's true. But then why would you pay someone a lot just to do the same old that anyone could do?
True.
Oh, executive pay. We'll never get to the bottom of that question. It's a circle that will never be squared. Let's talk about your other piece in the mag this week, which I find completely bizarre. We've probably talked about it before. I can't remember now. Heineken Punch Taverns. I can't get my head around this.
Yeah, so Heineken, obviously everyone will know as the Dutch brewer, and they'll be thinking, what on earth are they doing buying Punch Taverns, which is probably one of the largest pub groups in the UK by number of pubs. Heineken actually has a Star Pubs and Bars brand. They actually own quite a few pubs in the UK already.
Yeah, well, that
upwards of 1,000.
We didn't know.
No.
Probably been in them all.
But it's bidding to, it's hoping to, and we will find out tomorrow, actually, which will be Friday the 10th of February, whether the deal goes ahead. It's looking to buy 1,900 Punch Tavern pubs. There's a little bit of, I don't know, controversies, you know, maybe a strong word, uncertainty is probably a better one, from some of the Punch publicans who are concerned on two fronts about the deal. They're concerned about whether this will trigger what's known as an MRO event, and that's linked to new regulations, which were legislation, I should say, really, launched last year. And MRO is the market rent only option. So if there's a big change in your circumstances as a tenant of a leasing pub company, that can trigger a thing which gives you the right to decide whether to stay with the pub company as a tenant or go market rent only option. But you don't have very long to decide that, apparently. It's about 2 to 3 weeks. So publicans are concerned that if Heineken gets the go ahead tomorrow, then they've only got a few weeks to decide what they want to do. On the counter side of that, if it isn't a trigger event and it won't affect their standing, what they're then concerned about is whether Heineken can just rewrite the agreement.
Yeah, but equally, Punch is obviously looking to sell these pubs. If Heineken doesn't buy them, they will have to sell them off at some point anyway, possibly in a more piecemeal fashion.
Possibly, yeah. And also, I would say Heineken has said that these concerns about, you know, existing agreements being rewritten are not true. That's not what they're aiming to do. And they don't see it as a trigger event either. So they're not looking to have to deal with 1,900 inquiries from publicans about what they need to do in the next few weeks about the future of their pub. And actually today I had another statement from Heineken, which said that the Society of Independent Brewers has actually welcomed the announcement by Heineken about buying the pubs because they believe what Heineken has said, that Heineken will not force these pubs it's taking over to stock their own goods, basically, because the chap from the Punch Tenant Network that I spoke to said actually as a portfolio, something like 60% of stock across the board is Coors Lager, which obviously isn't owned by Heineken. So there's a fear that Heineken might sort of force these pubs to stock their products. But Heineken says, no, we're not doing that. It's not worth it. And SIBA, the Society of Independent Brewers, has said they believe them and they welcome that.
Is that likely to affect the vote on?
Well, this is it. It's a big question. I mean, I tried to get hold of some of the investors yesterday and I didn't have any luck. But I guess, if you believe Heineken, and there's no reason not to, that they won't just force Heineken beer and other products that they own on the pubs, which could impact those pubs' profitability, then I guess you wouldn't see any reason not to let it go through. And it's also slightly complicated, I suppose, as a Punch Taverns shareholder, because once the deal goes through, I don't think there's going to be a Punch listing, obviously, and Heineken is listed in Holland. So
you better figure it all out before Monday.
I know. I've got a lot of work to do. I'll do some market research over the weekend.
All right, thank you. Okay, so yeah, I mean, that's kind of the main news of the week. Unfortunately, we can't talk about the cover feature this week, which is written by James Norrington, because he's in the middle of moving house right now. What James is doing this week with the cover feature, which is excellent, is looking at big narratives in investing. And I think we've touched upon a few of those big narratives today, and how you have to basically be careful when you're looking at these in respect of investing. I actually talk about one of these big narratives in my editorial, which is the idea that e-commerce is this wonderful thing that's going to lift everybody that's exposed to it. But I think we had some evidence this week that that wasn't the case in DX Group and its massive profit warning. And you've written about this this week in respect of Amazon, which is obviously getting heavily involved in delivery space. And as you wrote in your excellent feature a few months back, is a massive threat to a lot of companies in this industry that are listed.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, logistics still is, I mean, however much truck you can place in the e-commerce, which
nice,
I think is I didn't even realize that one. I think it's significant. Obviously, it's, you know, it's long been hammering the high street. The actual heavy lifting side of it, logistics, is still intensely competitive. I mean, the profit warning from DX Group, I think there's clearly been some very poor expectation setting there. But I mean, it just shows how, particularly in the UK, how competitive that industry is at the moment, and how difficult it is to make money, really.
Yeah, I mean, my experience of this, my understanding of this, it's quite low margin. That you know, it's quite expensive to actually make a good logistics network work. You know, lots of investment in software, lots of investment in obviously people and trucks. And Amazon just, you know, when I thought about it, Amazon has something that the kind of incumbents in the industry don't, and that is this expertise in actually building software platforms
and robotics as well.
And I'd be very worried if I was invested in that sector. Even more worried than I was when I first read your feature, Alex. So yeah, DX, it was a shocker, but we've seen this coming.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bradley. Thank you very much, Alex. Plenty more of the magazine this week. Obviously, Personal Finance will be back with their podcast tomorrow, talking about everything in the Personal Finance Fund section. The big feature there is on VCTs, Venture Capital Trusts, which are a very, very tax-efficient way of investing in smaller companies. An interesting sector focus this week from Emma Powell, looking at the new regulatory changes about to affect the CFD and spread betting industry and how they can cope with that. Obviously, the usual tips. We're starting to crank up the results now. It's going to get busy as we get into February. Bet you'd be glad to be missing that, Bradley.
Yeah, it's very timely, Bradley.
Well, I'll still be covering some of them, actually, in my new job. So.
Not in the same way. Not the same intensity of an IC results season.
Of course not. I'll be looking upon them thinking, I wish I was that insightful.
When do you start?
The 20th.
Okay. Right, nice. You got a week off then?
Yeah.
Right, nice. And all the usual comments, a little bit more in the news section we haven't really talked about this morning. We've got a Q&A this week. Rosie Carr looking at some tax issues that we think are quite important that we don't really get a chance to cover very often because they're too difficult, but we try our best anyway.
Could I give a plug as well to Mark Robinson's interview with Red Tea Energy as well, which is another in the podcast feed you should have in front of you, is also on there.
Okay, he's finally done it, because I know he was supposed to do that one when he published his batteries feature a few weeks back.
It all ties together. It's all connected.
It does indeed. And we've got lots more podcasts coming up, which you'll be leading for us, Alex, which is why I hope you're sticking around for a while. Okay, thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Alex. And thank you all for listening. Fairy tale investing, why the big investment stories don't always have a happy ending, is the cover of the magazine this week. 4x90, all good news agents, or get online and subscribe. And we'll be back next week. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.